Welcome back to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. Today's episode is titled Music with Horns, and today we are exploring the horns, or the brass instruments, of the orchestra. That is, the French horn, trumpet, trombone, and tuba. We are exploring how they have been used throughout music history in a solo capacity and their usage in larger groupings. In our first half, we talked about the rich biblical history surrounding horns and brass instruments. We talked briefly about the physics of how the embouchure could change the pitch, and then what adding valves did to make these instruments more versatile. In our instrument-by-instrument approach, going through the four main instruments of this family, we got through the French horn and the trumpet. Before we get to the trombone and tuba, and then into our exploration of music that puts all the brass together, let's move into our backstage banter segment, where we interview performers on the concert circuit today for their perspectives on music. We will talk with a local trumpeter. We will also use this interview to serve as our classroom corner segment, where we explore different methods and curricula for introducing young people to music, since we'll be talking about both the performance aspects of the trumpet as well as certain educational aspects. This is a portion of a newly recorded composition by a colleague of mine here, Mark Jenkins. It's called Dedication Anthem and Fanfare, and it was premiered live at the dedication ceremony of Armstrong Auditorium back in September 2010. This piece heavily features the brass, particularly the trumpet, and in this studio orchestra recording, you're hearing trumpeter Dr. Carl Sievers. He is on the music faculty at the University of Oklahoma and is principal trumpet with the Oklahoma City Philharmonic and the University of Oklahoma Brass Quintet.
I started playing when I was 9 years old, which was fourth grade. My parents were always super supportive. They always took us to concerts a lot. And I always loved music. So when fourth grade rolled around when I was a kid, you know, I just was so excited to get started. They got me a $9 cornet, and I started with that. And I just, you know, it was just such a big deal to me. And a wonderful woman named Eleanor Ritchie was my first teacher. She was a violinist in the Louisville Orchestra. Studied with her, you know, through elementary school, and then got with a trumpeter from the Louisville Orchestra named Delbert Hoon. I studied with him from when I was 9 through my junior year of high school, and then studied with Leon Rapier, who was a really important figure to me in my life for all kinds of reasons. He was principal trumpet in the Louisville Orchestra. Studied with him my senior year, and then off to Indiana University, where I studied for a little while with Louis Davidson, who was principal trumpet in the Cleveland Orchestra for decades. But my most formative influence was a guy named William Adam, who I studied with throughout bachelor's, master's, and half of a doctorate degree.
And we'll get back to him.
Sure.
We talk about some of your approach to playing the trumpet. Talk about some of the major ensembles you performed in, some of the history there.
Well, oddly, I can't even really explain why such a great youth orchestra existed in Louisville, but in those days it was a very big deal. We played in Switzerland, traveled all over the place. We played all the Beethoven symphonies, a lot of the Shostakovich symphonies. By the time I got to college, I had a great deal of orchestral experience in a very good orchestra. And I also played in a jazz club from when I was 14 years old with a bunch of old guys. Looking back, a little surprised my parents let me do that. So I had a lot of ensemble performance experience. My senior year of high school, I won an audition to be principal trumpet in what was called the American Youth Performs Orchestra. So I played in Carnegie Hall and in the Kennedy Center with a really superb orchestra and chorus. By the time I got to college, I had done a lot of stuff, maybe not typical.
And then your current post is?
Yeah, I'm principal trumpet in the Oklahoma City Philharmonic, my 17th season coming up. You know, in the interim, before I moved here, I was probably more known as a commercial lead player, which to me is a little curious, a little bit unique, because a lot of times, you know, we specialize, and I used to struggle with the whole notion of specialization, but just decided I like to play everything, and I could be good, hopefully, at everything. So I did the live television show, the PTL Club, right after college. I did that for 7 years. I did all the, when we lived near Cincinnati for quite a while, and I did all the shows and the Aronoff Theater and in the Music Center, played principal in the ballet orchestra there. So I was doing a lot of orchestral stuff, but doing the commercial lead player thing all at the same time, which always, I just thought that was great, great fun and good.
So that gave you a lot of versatility to your playing.
Yeah, and trumpet players need to be.
Well, and that's something I was going to ask you just about how the trumpet players, because trumpets are used in basically every style of music there is, and put in a variety of different groupings, from solo to brass ensembles to orchestral to wind bands. Because of that versatility, you mentioned that some trumpeters specialize.
Yeah.
Is that the norm, or is it better for trumpet players to be well-versed in everything?
I think it's the norm to specialize, and a lot of players are versatile, but to be convincingly expert on a Brahms symphony and then go play in a jazz band is actually pretty rare. There are people that do it pretty well, but to do it really well is rare. And oddly, in our community, I do that, but Jay Wilkinson does, and Mike, and our whole section, Michael Anderson and the Philharmonic, are really good jazz players and really good orchestral players. Mm. But maybe the larger question is the versatility not only makes us marketable, but it feeds us artistically.
Right.
I try to explain to my students, okay, you got to be business savvy, and it opens a lot of doors to get work, but I enjoy all the different forms, and I'm just thrilled to share the stage with jazz artists or Yo-Yo Ma or all of the above, whoever it is.
And then the trumpets commonly have to play different tuned versions of the same instruments.
Yeah.
You know, in Baroque instrument, you'll have to pick up a piccolo trumpet.
Yep.
So what are some of the challenges that versatility requirement gives you?
Yeah, that can get to be a pretty long answer, but I'm trying to make sense of it for you. You know, generally speaking, in commercial and jazz, we play B-flat trumpet and flugelhorn, play cornet, which is a B-flat instrument, usually in brass bands, which I do as well. In the orchestra, the great predominance of what we use in there is the C trumpet, but in all of those situations, we constantly transpose. So in the orchestra, for example, in any given concert, I'll have parts in B flat, C, D, E flat, E, and F, sometimes within the same piece.
Mm.
So a good orchestral player transposes on site as well as he or she reads as written. Sometimes we'll match the instrument for a particular timbre or genre.
Right.
In the orchestra, most of the time, we just play one instrument and transpose. But when you're talking about Baroque literature that needs the piccolo trumpet, that comes in B-flat and A.
Mm-hmm.
Most of those works are written in D concert, so we play them on the A pick, which puts us in the key of F.
I see.
All that's a little bit of mental gymnastics, but the
right.
key of F avoids the worst intonation anomalies and is a fluent key.
Right.
And
so you're reading in one language and speaking in another
out loud,
something like that, I guess, for
and
someone.
And the parts can be in C or D, but they sound the same. So we're fluent transposers up the minor third or up the perfect fourth.
Right.
And then the whole can of worms of adapting to the feel and the blow and the response and the mouthpiece, there are different for all of that hardware.
Yeah, so there's just a whole lot of, like you said, mental gymnastics going on for that type of playing. Great. And then just some of the auxiliary things going along with the trumpet, people sticking things inside the bell.
Hopefully we mean mutes.
The mutes, of course. Talk about the purpose of mutes, the effects they create, the kind of different mutes there are.
Yeah, okay. So mute comes from a Latin word that means to change. And there was a time before valves where mutes were used to help an instrument change key.
Right.
A current day mute usually is to change tone color. And we have a blizzard of mutes. The guys in the orchestra, we'll own 30-plus mutes each.
Wow.
The basic families are straight mute, cup mute, harmon mute, and plunger mute. And there are some more esoteric ones that we use very occasionally, but we may use them to be super quiet, like in impressionistic work where we need to stay under the texture of a really quiet flute player.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you need a mute that's really edgy and metallic and angry sounding. Some are like jazz effects or even comical effects. Now those vary more according to what they're made of. And very thin aluminum, stainless steel, plastic. Some are made out of fabric, cardboard, wood, carpet. Just all kinds of stuff that we fuss with and to try to get the effect we want. And on the Philharmonic section, we also match whatever we discuss it. Jay and Mike and myself, what do we want to use on La Mer or on a Shostakovich piece? And we'll have a whole array of mutes there, and we try to make that all match so we sound unified.
Well, like in those orchestral type pieces, the trumpet player is sometimes the music, as you're probably aware, does, you're sitting there for a lot of it.
Oh, very aware.
Right. Yeah. and then you're just going to play in some of these key moments rather than throughout the entire piece. What are some of the benefits of that kind of playing, and what are some of the challenges?
Yeah, I would say it's mostly challenge, but you know, you get to sit there and listen to Valerie play, or any of the other great players, Lisa and Gay LeBlanc, and you get to listen to them play. But if you get too immersed in that, you might forget what you're doing. You know, oddly, with trumpet players are caricatured as egotistical, higher, louder, faster, and there's probably a lot of truth to those generalities. But I've often thought you earn your money as a symphony player on those touchy, quiet entrances where you've sat there for 300 measures and come in an awkward range, and your success is if nobody notices you. You know, you have to sneak in and play with a lot of finesse. Quite frankly, that's very tough. But we try to prepare for that and stay engaged. And, you know, the good trumpet players just have to prepare a lot. It's so physical and subtle. I'm always wary of analogies, but it's so much like golf. You know, if you got a great golf swing or hit at a mile, but you can't putt, you know, you just have to have it all together. And it's tough. It's demanding. And you're a solo voice, so every iota of sound you make, everybody knows it. You know, us, the first horn, oboe, and piccolo flute, you know, all the instruments are difficult and present their challenges, but if the oboe player, the piccolo, or the first trumpet player flurfs an entrance, everybody in the building knows, so it's can be a bit of pressure.
Right. That sound that you're making is produced by these lip muscles, that embouchure, as it's called. Even as a professional who's played for many years,
yeah.
What's your daily practice regimen like in order to keep that embouchure in tip-top shape?
It's a lot, you know, and when I'm asked, I'm not looking for a Boy Scout award or a pat on the back, but, you know, my wife will tell you, I usually get up at 5:30 every day, and before I get to work with my students, I have a regimen that takes about 2.5 hours that I just never miss doing. So it's a lot of things to get the breath relaxed, and a progressive set of studies that takes me through what I call all the skill sets. So lyrical playing, you know, near motion, chromatic, diatonic, more intervallic. I do flexibilities, all kinds of flexibilities for a brass player, or getting around the instrument without using your fingers. Lip slurs, they call them. And I do every form of tonguing possible, and in every dynamic extreme, and then extremes of range. And put it all together, and I do that 7 days a week. But it to be a good high brass player takes a lot of maintenance.
Right. Well, let's move more into the segment about music education,
sure.
The classroom corner element of the show. Any great musician has to start somewhat young. You started, like you said, in fourth grade.
Yeah, 9 years old.
But, you know, those bigger instruments like trombones, tubas, I don't think 9-year-olds are starting with some of those bigger instruments. They simply have to wait till they're physically bigger. It seems as one way that educators will introduce them to those bigger brass instruments is to start them with the trumpet. I mean, can you talk about the benefits of learning the trumpet, in particularly in how it prepares for other brass instruments, but maybe just overall general benefits?
Yeah, things people may not think about, even with trumpet, when you're a little person, cornets preferred, in my opinion, because, you know, to hold a trumpet's pretty long and can be tough to hold up even when you're a little guy. But
the cornet's just more compact.
Cornet's shorter. It's different. The tubing's wrapped differently. It's essentially identical. It's more the same than it's not. But so you got a couple ways to go at this answer. I think what people may not think of is from the get-go, you're working on ears. You're working on the triggers and kinesthetic responses of seeing symbols on a page, and that triggers a sound in your mind. And that's beneficial, period, and applies to any instrument. Mm-hmm. Most of the fingering patterns among the brasses, now trombone's different, of course, because it has no valves. But with the valved brasses, the finger patterns are the same, so that carries over. The basic delivery of the breath and how the face sets up, you know, we use the word embouchure, which is a little murky and easily misinterpreted, but that's similar for all of them. The resistance of the pipe, the air column in the pipe, is greatest with the smaller instruments and least with the big ones. So that's a little bit of an adjustment. But you're still seeing symbols on the page, converting that into your sound in your intuitive mind, learning to breathe and sustain and all those things. So, yeah, because the tubas are huge and Maybe that's for when they hit a growth spurt and are ready for it. But realistically, it's probably the only way to go is to start them on trumpet or cornet until they get a little bigger.
And then you were talking before about the formative influence on you mm-hmm. when you were learning the trumpet, and that affects your approach. First, well, let's talk about that, but first, maybe describe your teaching position and where you've taught through your career.
Yeah, okay. So I'm a tenured full professor at the University of Oklahoma School of Music since 1999. Before that, I taught at Wright State University, which is suburban Dayton, Ohio. Before that, I was at Northwest Missouri State, which is, like the name says, in the northwest corner of the state, a very good small music ed focused school, but everything they did well. I really liked my time there. Before that, I taught part-time at Winthrop College, which is in the northern edge of South Carolina, right across the state line from Charlotte. But that's while I was doing the PTO Club TV show. And I always wanted to teach because the most important people in my life other than my family have been my teachers. And they just so hugely impacted me. I've always had a heart for teaching.
And your approach to teaching the trumpet, is it a little unique compared to other approaches?
Yeah, I think it is. And, you know, when you answer a question that way, I always have to be really alert that that's not my ego talking, that it's really something of value.
Right.
And maybe better. So I'm going to mention Eleanor Ritchie again, my very first teacher. And when I say she loved me, you know, as a human being, well, what's that got to do with it? Well, she was a violinist. She didn't play the trumpet. So the subtleties there were, I just couldn't wait till Thursday afternoons when Eleanor Ritchie came to school. She was like Aunt B, kind of a, you know, heavyset older lady and just sweet as she could be. But because she was not a trumpet player, she taught me melody and line and music. Mm. And then the mechanics became a product of that.
Right.
So that sets the ball rolling for what Mr. Adam at Indiana University was a real expert at. He died just about 2 years ago at age 96 and was teaching up until the end. Yeah, a really remarkable man. So it's impossible to explain, you know, in a concise, brief fashion what was different about his approach, but essentially it's getting the causes and the results in the right place. And I suggest that contemporary music education has that backwards, that you can't teach physical skill by teaching the mechanics, that you instead focus on the product so well-defined and with such commitment that the mechanics, the part of your brain that tells the muscles what to do, now has the information it needs to tell those muscles what to do. And to form an embouchure or teach breathing or any of those other things is just destined for tying yourself up in knots. And then there's always the one kid who's so intuitive, who plays beautifully anyway. But I don't want a studio of 20 students where two of them play well and the rest of them are floundering. I want all 20 of them to play well. And so when I say that it's about focusing on that product and defining it very well, in a way it's that simple, but there's a lot of science to it. We take that through carefully chosen exercises and regimens that are progressive and learn to develop this very characteristic tone. And then as they're able to keep that intact through the different regimens I devise for them, then embouchure and air and all those subtle mechanical things are all in perfect phase, and they all just play beautifully. And in fact, they all do.
Wow. So it's basically the philosophy or mentality of they have the end goal, the prize, the vision, whatever you want to call it, in mind. And that's guiding their musical experience.
Absolutely.
Their educational experience.
But it's very well defined. It's not vague. You know, I tell my students, I want to be a fireman. You know, I have a six-year-old kid. What do you want to do? Well, we want to be, what color's the truck? Every little iota of detail is fleshed out. And then you have to map out the steps to the goal. So Mr. Adam taught us we're goal-seeking mechanisms, but we have to have the steps to get there mapped out, and they're adjustable on the way if needed. But a lot of people will hear what I have to say and say, well, just imagine sounding good. That's not enough. Well, you got to take it farther than that.
Right.
And then the flip of that would be, if you want to foul up a really great golfer, ask him what his thumb's doing on his backswing, or, you know, get him thinking about the minutia, and then the next thing you know, he's hitting one into the trees. So, but that's what musicians tend to do. They get wrapped up in the technique and trying to play correctly, and then the vision of sounding fabulous is now peripheral instead of focal.
Right. So that focal vision, like you said, it's specific. It's very detailed what they're what they're listening for.
Absolutely. And a constant work in progress.
That's fantastic. Well, I really appreciate you sharing those thoughts with us today. Thanks so much for your time.
Sure. Glad to do it.
You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. That was my interview with Dr. Carl Sievers, principal trumpet with the Oklahoma City Philharmonic and trumpet professor at the University of Oklahoma. To start that segment, I played a portion of a studio orchestra recording that he was involved in, a piece that heavily features Dr. Sievers. Here it is in its entirety. This is the Dedication Anthem and Fanfare by Mark Jenkins, premiered live, as I said, at the dedication ceremony of Armstrong Auditorium here on the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, and then just recently released to many major digital stores as recorded by a studio orchestra. Was Mark Jenkins' recently released recording of his dedication anthem and fanfare performed by a studio orchestra featuring our interview subject for today on the trumpet, Dr. Carl Sievers. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Music with Horns. We are exploring the brass instruments of the orchestra, how they've been used throughout music history, and some of the great moments in the standard repertoire. To this point, we've discussed the ancient history of these horns. In our discussion of the four main instruments of the brass family, we've gotten through the French horn and the trumpet. Now let's move into our discussion of the trombone, sometimes nicknamed the bone, or my favorite, the T-bone. This instrument originated from a bass trumpet when, around the 15th century, a tuning slide was added to give it more flexibility in terms of pitch. The trombone, as we know it today, is played by placing the right hand on the slide, moving it up and down to maneuver pitch changes. Like the trumpet, this instrument is also versatile in terms of the style of music it participates in. It can be found in brass bands, symphonic bands, Dixieland bands, swing bands, and the symphony orchestra. It wasn't used heavily in the symphony orchestra until the time of Beethoven in the early 19th century. But just before that, there is a famous vocal work that features a solo trombone alongside the singer. We've already heard a trumpet solo that was treated that way, featured alongside a soprano in Handel's aria, Let the Bright Seraphim. This is from a time just after Handel. This is a work of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. This is from his famous Requiem, basically the last thing he wrote. This Latin Mass for the Dead contains a portion of text that translates, "The trumpet, scattering a wondrous sound through the regions of sepulchres, will summon all before the throne." So this text, titled Tuba Mirum, is similar to the text Handel set in Messiah about the trumpet sounding and the dead being raised. Except instead of using a literal trumpet along with the singer to evoke the idea of a trumpet, Mozart uses the larger trumpet, or the larger bass trumpet, or the trombone. So here is a portion of Mozart's Tuba Mirum, meaning the wondrous trumpet, from a recording done by the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields and Chorus. Robert Lloyd is the bass soloist. That was Tuba Mirum from Mozart's Requiem, performed by the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields with Sir Neville Mariner conducting. It was an example of a solo trombone in the classical repertoire. There, the trombone represented the sound of a wondrous trumpet that sounds at the time of a resurrection from the dead. We're going to hear an example of that same text when we put all the brass instruments back together, too. And that will be quite the contrast to hear a late Romantic era composer's take on the same text that Mozart set there. More on that later. But next, let's put the trombones together in a section. The most famous trombone sectional playing is probably the main theme of Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries. But I've played that on this show a couple times already. Let's hear a moment of the overture to Wagner's opera, Tannhäuser. It has a majestic melody that is covered by the trombones and supported by other horns as well. Let's hear it here, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic, Claudio Abbado conducting. So that was an excerpt of Richard Wagner's overture to his opera Tannhäuser, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic under the baton of Claudio Abbado. That was an example of a lot of trombones playing together. Now let's move to the final instrument of our brass discussion on today's episode of Music for Life, the tuba. You may have picked up on the fact that the word tuba is Latin for trumpet or horn. But the tuba, as we know it in English, is not a trumpet, but rather the largest and therefore the lowest of the brass instruments. Its mouthpiece is so big, it's sometimes called a bowl. It was invented in the mid-19th century, and it replaced two earlier low brass instruments, the ophicleide and the earlier serpent, which wasn't really made of brass, but provided a similar function and tone color as the modern tuba. You may have heard of the sousaphone. That is basically a tuba that was reconfigured at the request of American bandleader and composer John Philip Sousa. The new shape, circling around the player's torso, also made it possible to be able to be held while standing, and definitely much easier to march with. The tuba has great depth and mellowness, and is sometimes known as the oompah instrument because of its function playing the oompah in a march. There are simply too many examples of this to play, but here's an example of a trombone tuba duet in the Canadian Brass's arrangement of When the Saints Go Marching In.
More, more, more.
In the standard orchestra, the tuba is most often played in its lower register, providing rich supportive harmony for the symphonic sound. There isn't a lot of well-known solo repertoire for this instrument, and so what I'm going to do to get you to hear more tuba playing is put all the brass instruments together in a small group. A common brass grouping is the brass quintet, two trumpets, French horn, trombone, and tuba. And the most famous brass quintet in the world has to be the Canadian Brass. Here's their recording of Bach's Little Fugue in G minor. This will give your ears a great compare and contrast for the various brass instruments and how they sound all together. And if you want to know what the tuba sounds like, listen for the lowest sounding instrument. That was Johann Sebastian Bach's Little Fugue in G minor, and it put all four brass instruments together in a brass quintet, which features two trumpets. We heard it performed by arguably the most famous brass quintet around, the Canadian Brass. On today's episode of Music for Life, titled Music with Horns, we have explored each major brass instrument of the orchestra. Now we are putting them back together, as you just heard in that brass quintet. But let's hear great brass section moments in orchestral music. We already heard the overture to Tannhäuser, which featured the lower brass sections of trombones and horns. We also heard at the opening of this episode the resounding final movement of Respighi's Pines of Rome. But what I want to play next is a segment of Giuseppe Verdi's Requiem. We've already heard some great trumpet writing by Verdi from his opera Aida, and we've already heard a part of another requiem, that of Mozart's. Here's the same text Mozart set. Mozart used a solo trombone to discuss the wondrous sound of the trumpet that awakens people from their sepulchres. Verdi, composing in the bigger is better late Romantic era, uses several trumpets and then the entire brass section in this dramatic build-up. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Music with Horns. We are exploring the brass instruments of the orchestra, how they've been used throughout music history, and some of the great moments in the standard repertoire for these horns. That was the Vienna State Opera Chorus and the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra performing the Tuba Mirum section of Giuseppe Verdi's Requiem, a section of the text that talks about the wondrous trumpet. Verdi uses several trumpets and then the entire brass section to depict this text. One of my personal favorite moments of brass ensemble playing has to be Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man. This is one of Copland's best-known works. It is scored for four horns, three trumpets, three trombones, tuba, timpani, tam-tam, a type of gong, and a bass drum. This is a recording by the Seattle Symphony Orchestra under the baton of Gerard Schwartz.
Thank you.
You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone, and today's episode is titled Music with Horns. We are exploring the brass instruments of the orchestra and how they've been used through music history, either in a solo capacity or as a grouping of instruments. And we just heard Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man, performed by the Seattle Symphony Orchestra and conductor Gerard Schwartz. And since we're exploring the horns of the orchestra today, I would be remiss not to play you an unusual horn requirement in a now very popular piece of music. Maybe when you think of horns, you think of the head of an animal or a musical instrument, but you might also think of an automobile honking at you. Well, when George Gershwin wrote his famous jazz-influenced orchestral work, An American in Paris, he was able to evoke the sounds of Paris by scoring the piece to include Parisian taxi horns, which he brought back from Paris to be used in the New York premiere of this work. Now you can buy tuned taxi horns from instrument vendors if you want to perform this piece. Here's that section of George Gershwin's symphonic poem, An American in Paris, performed by James Levine conducting the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. So that was an excerpt from George Gershwin's symphonic poem, An American in Paris, performed by James Levine conducting the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And you heard the taxi horns that Gershwin required in this work, as well as some other great brass section writing. This jazz-influenced piece leads us into our dessert for today's program, where we hear some lighter fare to end our show, usually an example from the popular or folk tradition. So let's hear some jazz. Earlier, we heard a composition of a colleague of mine, Mark Jenkins. He is actually quite an accomplished jazz performer and arranger. He took a religious children's song by the Gaither Vocal Band and arranged it into a bebop jazz style for one of the Christian contemporary vocal albums produced here at Herbert W. Armstrong College. I want to end the program with a portion of this vocal quartet because it features both a trumpet and trombone solo, quite amazing solos actually, by local musicians Kirk Palmer on the trumpet and Jeff Kidwell on trombone. You'll hear the variety of colors that both of these instruments are capable of, the trumpet's ability to attack and sustain notes in diverse ways, and the trombone's ability to bend the pitch ever so slightly by the use of its slide. So enjoy I Am a Promise.
Go. I can be anything that he wants me to be. I can climb the high mountain. I can cross the wide sea.
I am a great big promise, you see. I am a promise. I am a possibility. I am a promise with a capital P. I am a great big bundle of potentiality. And if you listen, you can hear God's voice, and if you're trying, He'll help you make the right choice. I am a promise to be
anything God wants me to
be. I'm a promise to be anything God wants. I'm a promise to be anything God wants me to be.
You have been listening to Music for Life. From the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.